This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Dogs of Venice, written by Stephen Rowley, performed by Neil Patrick Harris. Paul first saw the dog from his loft's picture window, which overlooked one of the city's quieter canals. The animal trotted along the narrow walkway on the far side of the water with an enviable nonchalance, its brindle scruff a perfect match for cobblestone, a white stripe running down its nose. Unleashed and alone, the dog moved with assurance and purpose, ignoring an old man with a cane carrying a bakery box headed in the opposite direction. It scampered up and over a small footbridge as if this were part of a daily commute, before disappearing out of sight. The image left an indelible impression. Paul had been in Venice for 2 days, arriving in Italy from New York via Paris, JFK to Charles de Gaulle to Marco Polo, before a water taxi ferried him briskly across the Laguna Veneta, a bay in the Adriatic Sea. It was a trip he had planned with his husband, until a month ago when Darren, while they were admiring Bergdorf's avant-garde Christmas windows of all things, had decided their marriage was through. Paul had forced himself onto the plane anyway, thinking it would help him grow comfortable being alone, like throwing a child into the deep end in order to teach him to swim. Right away, he'd noticed several of these street dogs. With no cars in Venice, they enjoyed the run of it. None were leashed. Only one he encountered was muzzled. There were very few rules regarding dogs, it seemed. Animals apparently weren't allowed in markets, but even that seemed negotiable to the Italians. While buying a bottle of Suave and a local selection of cheeses, Paul had witnessed a corgi patiently waiting for its owner by the checkout, and no one had appeared to mind. Outside another shop in the Campo Santa Margherita, a small pooch demanded the complete attention of a security guard, who was more than happy to oblige. These dogs seemed to rule the roost, but there was something about this dog's shabby confidence that stirred an awakening in Paul. It was so comfortable in its own skin and possessed such command. He could easily picture the dog waiting nightly in an alley behind a sleepy bistro for the chef to reveal from under a cloche a leftover bone from the kitchen's special osso buco. Before the dog was even a memory, Paul thought, "That's who I want to be." He prized his tranquil mornings in the loft's window, his only companions a cappuccino and a slice of the panettone that had been left for him by the property manager upon check-in. But instinctually, he knew he was cheating. Anyone can be alone behind closed doors. The goal was to be comfortable by himself in a cafe, under the gaze of watchful eyes. Still, he reasoned, these mornings were a start and gave him something to build on. The panettone was dry, much like last night's wine, but that was fine. It suited his mood. He was brittle still and forlorn, delighted only in spite of himself by the soft January light that made it feel like he'd stepped into a Renaissance artist's paint box and the occasional gondolier in traditional Venetian stripes rowing by. And it wasn't like he hadn't ventured outside. He'd toured Venice on foot, getting blissfully lost and finding his way again, looking down at the beautiful blue-green waters that filled an endless maze of canals, and then up for signs pointing to familiar landmarks like the Piazza San Marco or the Ponte de Rialto, sometimes the only clues to guide him home. An app on his phone informed him he'd averaged 19,000 steps each day. To his barking feet, it felt like more. Despite small pangs of guilt over these mornings indoors, he concluded he'd earned a quiet start to the day. So he sipped his coffee and waited for the dog to come back. At lunchtime, and with no sign of his four-legged friend, Paul picked at leftover ravioli from his meal the night before. He'd stumbled on a treasure, the Osteria alla Testiere, and had felt confident as he sat down for his meal. After three bites, he'd succumbed to relentless self-consciousness and asked for the rest of his food to go. He put aside a prawn and a bit of ravioli, placed them on a saucer, which he then set outside on the edge of the walkway close to a wall. If nothing else, he hoped it would lure the dog back this way. He returned to his window to let the bait do its work, and while he waited, wrote a few thoughts on the trip in his journal. Already he'd experienced magnificent things, art and history and ancient architecture, cathedrals and basilicas. New York had these things too, although they were slightly less ancient. But he hardly noticed them anymore, consumed as he was by life's daily drudgery. Sights became obstacles that drew crowds that were difficult to navigate around. Here, he had become an expert at lingering near tour groups without joining them, eavesdropping on facts that piqued his interest before detaching and scuttling away. It was how he felt about society as a whole, always on the outside of it and never quite part of the group, one of the reasons why he'd always valued his marriage. He found comfort in partnership, even when that union was, apparently, a sham. But he loved learning things, so he listened. An enduring interest in the world made him feel slightly less like a loner. There were 417 bridges in Venice, but 72 of them were private. There were 350 or so gondolas, but more than 400 gondolieri, so some of them had to share. Venice was sinking at the rate of 1, maybe 2 millimeters a year, which didn't sound like much, but the city was already built on a precarious foundation. Each guide would offer such facts before raising a closed umbrella or bright-colored cap to signal the group. The tour would then follow the guide as he or she offered more numbers and figures and stats, and Paul would continue alone. It wasn't like anything these tours could offer would distract him from some telling numbers of his own. Paul made a list in his journal. While he was 4,000 miles from home, his one husband was moving out. When he returned to their third-floor Gramercy Park apartment, scores of things would be gone. Hundreds of arguments, dozens of holidays, 15 birthdays, 2,755 goodnights. Paul, it seemed, was sinking much faster than Venice. He, too, was on shifting ground. Until he recognized in a street dog the confidence he lacked in himself. And the dog became his central fascination. He'd come to Venice not to observe but to grow. He'd written as much on the plane over Newfoundland. He thought the dog could perhaps be a teacher, as Paul had much to learn. Alas, it was apparently uninterested in prawns. He thought of the dog all afternoon at the Guggenheim, where Peggy, niece of Solomon, was buried next to her 14 Lhasa Apsos in the hope that they would join her in the afterlife. Paul rented an audio tour to quell his nerves. It was okay not to have someone to talk to when listening to a headset. Peggy was, the tour said, unparalleled as a collector and curator. Highlights included Picassos and Dalís and Pollocks. But Paul was drawn outdoors, where a simple plaque marked the resting place of her beloved Lhasa Apsos. Cappuccino, Peacock, Pagine, Toro, Folia, Madam Butterfly, Baby, Emily, White Angel, Sir Herbert, Sable, Gypsy, Hong Kong, and Celida. He wondered if he should give his dog a name, the one he'd seen and hoped to see again. But a name suggested a kind of ownership, and Paul knew what his fascination meant. It was the dog, in fact, who owned him. Paul decided to think of him simply as the dog. Later, in line to climb the Campanile di San Marco to watch the sunset from the Bell Towers Observatory, he spotted the dog a second time. He wasn't certain at first, but the white stripe on his snout gave the dog's identity away. He bustled past Paul with the same air as before, expertly navigating his way through the throng of tourists. Paul's heart beat faster and his whole body constricted, the way it had long ago when he had unexpectedly seen Darren in Bryant Park dining with another man before they'd made their relationship exclusive.
Mi scusi,
he said to the elderly gentleman behind him, who was smoking some sort of European cigarillo. He bolted from the line to chase after the dog, who was already giving him the slip. His canine friend kept a serious-minded pace toward his destination, the cafe tables on the far side of the flagpoles that marked the entrance to the piazza. Paul kept a distance he thought would be safe, knowing an animal could change course on a dime. He desperately didn't want to lose him. He wanted to get close to, but not interfere with, the dog's grift. He was there to observe. People enjoying their early dinners, Americans mostly, always concerned with food, and also some Japanese, tossed bits of pastry or bread or a bite of prosciutto from a sandwich. Paul marveled at the scam. It worked because the dog never begged, never showed much in the way of interest or gratitude. He didn't stick around for more than he was offered. It was like he was happy to connect, but he didn't expect connection. And he worked the tables efficiently, tolerating a few scratches behind the ears before moving on, weaving under the archways framing the storefronts like none of this had happened. That was Paul's mistake, at least according to Darren. He had always expected too much. He'd even said this to Paul while they were first dating, the accusation dripping with a displeasure that didn't fully register with Paul until a good while later. Perhaps their pairing should have been capped after a few dates, before they consented to a relationship. Or at most, a seasonal fling, a warm body with which to get through the winter if an expiration date was so obvious. But Paul had pushed, wanting more as he always did, eager to give away the key to his heart. And why not? He thought they enjoyed each other's company. When Darren accepted his proposal, he actually seemed to delight in planning their wedding, and for a while things were good. Paul asked him in the fizzled tail of one of their fiery arguments, why, if he was unhappy, did he say yes? Darren answered that he had hoped marriage would calm Paul's neuroses, that if Paul could accept that they were together, their union legally sanctioned by the state, he would eventually hold Darren a little less tight. But having someone made Paul more afraid of losing them, not less. In their therapist's office, Darren accused Paul of wanting a conjoined twin more than a husband. And the marriage was over in less than 5 years. College for each of them, including their graduate degrees, had been longer. Paul pursued the dog through the archways, pushing through a family who had stopped to gawk at pastries. Sensing a chase, the dog picked up his pace until both of them were at a full sprint, as if he knew what Paul did. A James Bond movie had been filmed in the very same spot. The dog had an easier time of it than Paul. He was more nimble, able to pivot and dodge. His focus was singular, getting away. Paul was slowed by apologizing, by caring enough not to offend, to appear rational in the throes of an obsession that was anything but. When he burst out of the piazza by the waterfront, he caught a glimpse of the dog running in the distance before ducking into an alley. By the time Paul reached the alley, he was gone. Paul stopped along the waterfront to catch his breath, staring at the bay, watching the boats come and go from Murano. He hated that Darren was right. When Paul was lucky enough to get something he liked, he always stayed for more. He couldn't help it. It was how he was built, which was what made the dog such an enigma. How could any creature find satisfaction in meaningless interactions and scraps? But the world was not like that, not like him. The world was much more like the dog. People were callous, inattentive, fed on diets of apps and devices that were constantly changing and new. He knew he had to learn to at least appear nonchalant. His future happiness depended on it. If he could only corner his teacher. As he stood watching the gulls glide over the gondolas docked for the night, pondering how a stray dog could be better suited for the world than he, Paul was distracted by a portly tour guide's loud whistling as he casually counted the day's tips. Dressed in an oversized cable-knit sweater that made him seem even rounder, he looked like the kind of man Bob Hoskins used to play on films. Gruff, but amiable underneath. Paul focused on the gondolas, so he wouldn't appear to be lurking, and waited for the man to finish his count before speaking.
Miscusi, may I ask you a question? Paul asked.
All the guides spoke English.
But of course!
The man's tone was enthusiastic, as if he were eager to answer. He checked his watch nonetheless. By day, he played a character, the jovial Italian. Most of the guides and gondolieri did, like they were seconds away from singing. But in the last ribbon of daylight, it was clear this man was eager to hang up his cap.
The dogs I see running around the city, the street dogs.
Paul realized in his effort to make this quick, he hadn't proffered much of a question. He scrambled to follow up.
Do they belong to anyone? Residents?
The man was bald with a salt-and-pepper beard and wore a scarf tied around his neck. He looked up and down the waterfront, perhaps for an example of one of these dogs. But it was nearing dinner, and they no doubt had retreated for food.
There is a saint, he began. San Rocco? Saint Rock in English, yes? The patron saint of dogs, among other things. The falsely accused and the bachelors. He's very important to Venice. A dog saved San Rocco when he was suffering by bringing him bread and licking his wounds. Tomorrow you visit the Chiesa di San Rocco, the Church of Saint Rock. There you will learn more.
He pointed west and a little bit north, a direction Paul assumed led to the church.
Dogs, they are part of the city of Venice. Do they belong? They are domesticated, that is the word. A few wander the city. Rome has cats, Venice has dogs. Me, I have two cats, but I prefer Venezia to Roma.
He shrugged. What are you going to do? Then tucked his money in a waste bag under his coat.
I've seen the cats in Rome, Paul said,
and he had. He and Darren had traveled there 2 summers ago, after a week on the Italian coast. They'd sought out a cat sanctuary, known as the Torre Argentina, after hearing a profile on the woman who ran it on NPR's Weekend Edition. Hundreds of cats roamed the ruins where Caesar was murdered, sunbathing on ancient pillars and steps. Darren had made a joke at the time. No wonder cats liked the place given its history. Dogs, who valued loyalty, would never assemble in a place of betrayal. Paul reached into his pocket for euros and handed the guide several coins.
Grazie.
Ciao,
the man said, happily accepting his tip. Then he repeated,
Chiesa di San Rocco,
and gave Paul a thumbs up. Alone again, Paul strolled the waterfront with this new information, wondering if the dog had a family, or if all of Venice was his home. Certainly cats could be feral. It wasn't just Rome that had those. But dogs? They seemed, like him, more dependent. He weaved through the crowds that gathered to watch the last of the sun color the waters that fed the Grand Canal, then turned to look above the city's rooftops. He could just make out the tip of the bell tower, but it was too late to rejoin the queue for the observatory. He could try again tomorrow. Besides, he was content where he was. Before, he'd enjoyed the anonymity this strange city offered him, reasoning he could be anyone and others would not judge.
But in this moment, he took comfort in the people around him, letting these strangers ease the aching loneliness that hid underneath the facade. The patron saint of dogs, bachelors, and the falsely accused, Paul thought. How were these things assigned? Randomly, upon canonization? Did they pick slips of paper from a bowl? Peter, you get premature baldness, cabbage, and sloths. John, sandwich cookies with double the filling, dolphins, and adults who can't tell time. His own name came from Paul the Apostle. His mother's love of the church confirmed that. But he had no earthly clue of what Paul was the patron saint. Men who don't like canned peas? Still, even in the midst of these absurd thoughts, Paul could see a connection, a certain wisdom in the assignments to San Rocco, and it made him feel less alone. Perhaps his new bachelordom was why he felt an affinity for this dog, or how he felt falsely accused by his own husband of being so needy. Ex-husband. It was all over but the paperwork. On his phone, Paul made a note, Chiesa di San Rocco. He felt a pressing need to know more about Saint Rock, and the church would certainly be something to see. He wanted to know everything about this saint that was looking out for him. At 9, Paul dressed for dinner and headed for a late meal at La Zucca, a bistro that was raved about in his guidebook, a proper dinner alone still his Everest. He had never had much interest in animal meat other than fish, and the restaurant's vegetarian-friendly menu appealed to him. Over the course of their relationship, Darren's strict vegetarian cooking had pushed him away from meat even more. In defiance of his ex, he thought about a meaty ragu, thinking it might even be a better offering for the dog. But there was no point in losing himself to spite someone else. Besides, the night already felt full of promise, as if he were about to settle an old score. How are you going to travel by yourself? You can't even eat lunch unescorted, Darren had said when Paul announced he was still taking their trip. And there was plenty of truth to his husband's observation. Paul had always felt self-conscious alone. But look at me now, he thought, making his way to a restaurant clear on the other side of the world. Perhaps Paul was the saint of proving doubters wrong. If only he could get through tonight's meal. If nothing else, he was looking forward to ordering as he pleased. Darren always wanted to share. And a menu that didn't require his phone's constant translating, wondering if unfamiliar Italian words were types of cheeses or meats. The January air was crisp, pleasant. Paul wore a scarf he'd purchased in one of the local boutiques, tied in the fashion the shop girl had shown him. It made him feel very Italian. With his curls swooped under a knit cap and his quilted coat, he thought he looked rather Italian too, but like a fisherman, perhaps, from Cinque Terre. He searched for the dog as he wove through the streets, wondering the whole time if anyone, even the natives, ever learned their way around. He'd overheard a shopkeeper mention to a tourist that the population of Venice had been cut in half over the last 50 years, which, despite the throngs of people that made the city feel swollen, Paul had no reason to believe was untrue. Residents were fed up with the foreigners, perhaps, or the difficult way of life. Yet, the dog seemed somehow to thrive, so it was still suitable for some. He crossed over the Grand Canal on the Rialto and stumbled around until he found a statue he recognized. After several more rights, three lefts, a handful of narrow bridges over the smaller waterways, and a quick consultation with his phone, he found the restaurant. Lit with soft moonlight, it took on the aura of a Hollywood film set. Buonasera, he said to the host, rubbing his hands in the warmth of the small osteria. Reservation for Hafner. His Italian was conversational at best, but it didn't matter. In a restaurant such as this, most everyone spoke English.
Lazuka was outfitted with homey, wood-paneled walls with an inviting wine collection lining the back. The air smelled of butter and sage. The atmosphere was warm, exotic in the way that Europe feels different from America, but comfortable and familiar too, like a distant relative's home, filled with voices that melted into an ambient din. Paul was seated alone at a table for two. Get back on the horse, he thought. The chair opposite him, embarrassingly, the lone empty seat in the place. He had come prepared with a paperback copy of some thriller he'd picked up at the airport, as well as a long article from The New Yorker he'd downloaded on his phone. It was important, he felt, to acclimate. If he was going to at least get as far as a fourth bite tonight, he couldn't rely on his crutches up front. A handsome waiter offered him bread. His thick, dark hair was peppered with premature salt, and his eyes were deep-set and brown. They paired well with a ready smile. His looks made Paul so nervous he ordered two dishes, a tagliatelle with artichoke and pecorino cheese, and a zucchini lasagna, which the waiter called indimenticabile, along with a cortino of wine. Paul hoped two entrees would help mask the fact that he was one, saving him face in front of the staff. When the waiter left, he dragged his bread through olive oil, cursing himself for being so awkward. When his dinner arrived, Paul concentrated on his food and didn't look at his paperback once. It was, he imagined, what the dog would have done. The tagliatelle belied its simple ingredients. The cheese shaved to perfection so that it stood up to the dish, and the artichokes browned to offset their briny flavor. The lasagna was layered with three sauces, each failing to disappoint. The waiter was right. It was unforgettable. He was amazed at how different food tasted when it was the sole focus, absent the distraction of conversation. While their arguments had often centered around Paul's faults, Darren was not without his own. Barreling through a meal like it was a 100-yard dash and talking with his mouth full were but two. The looks Paul would get when Darren was finished and his own plate hardly touched were withering. But now Paul lingered in the candlelight, savoring each forkful with an appreciation for both ingredient and technique, unearthing the china pattern on the restaurant's dishes with the slow precision of an archaeologist. He wrapped some of the lasagna in a napkin for the dog and tucked it in his coat pocket. When he took his last bite and set down his fork, Paul was surprised to see there were empty seats all around him.
Your meal was good, yes?
It was the handsome waiter smoking a cigarette beside the osteria's front door. Paul stood and breathed in the night air with its hint of tobacco, in no hurry to return to his loft, stealing glances when he could at the young man's profile and his strong, aquiline nose. Meals, Paul replied, emphasizing the plural and taking himself down a peg. He had been basking in the triumph of his evening and thought it better to pierce his success with a joke before someone else could step forth with a sharper barb. They both laughed, much to Paul's relief.
In Venice alone?
The waiter asked, his stare intense, cutting right to Paul's deepest insecurity. It may have been the shadows, but Paul swore his scruff had darkened since he'd first arrived at his table with bread. He was overcome with a sudden desire to touch it, rub it like sandpaper across his bare skin just to see what it felt like. Darren's face had always been boyish and smooth. Sadly, Paul shrugged before looking down at his shoes, scuffed from walking the city. Dining alone had made Paul a tourist attraction unto himself.
Not sad for me.
The waiter smiled, giving Paul a sudden appreciation for truth.
I like your sharpa. Very Italian.
It took Paul a moment to follow, but then he loosened the scarf around his neck, making it easier to breathe.
My scarf? Sharpa, yes.
I have one just like. The waiter pulled his own scarf out of his back pocket. It was nothing like Paul's.
Do you know your way at night? Streets in Venice are full of dark.
They are, Paul agreed, looking up at the half moon and suddenly wishing it were full. The city's gloomy emptiness at this late hour made it infinitely more menacing. In New York, the streets were wide and alive, never empty of cars, which flew like hail at all hours.
I walk with you.
The waiter dropped the butt of his cigarette and crushed it out with his foot.
What, right now?
The waiter looked confused.
Yes, I finish for the night. You? Or would you like more lasagna?
It was all so forward, it took Paul by surprise, and he blushed at the suggestion he wasn't yet sated. Paul, he said, offering his hand, not knowing what else to say. The waiter took Paul's hand and shook it without breaking his gaze.
Nicola.
His hand was surprisingly warm, as if he'd just served a hot dish.
After you.
Together, they walked through the winding streets, talking the whole way about Italy, about Venice. Nicola, the one tour guide Paul didn't shy away from, and it felt good not to just eavesdrop, but to actually listen, and to be able to offer his own insight in return.
Venice is more than cento isole, islands,
Nicola offered.
Cento, 100? See. Many, many bridges to connect them all.
In that moment, Paul was a bridge, yearning to connect. He just didn't want to be walked over.
I heard Venice is shrinking, he said.
Sinking, Nicola said, correcting him.
That too.
And indeed, the ground felt like it was shifting under his feet.
But I mean fewer people.
Ah, Nicola said. Yes, people leave.
It was a punch to Paul's full stomach. He stared at his companion, wondering if he had any idea how profound his simple observations were. People leave. Darren had left. His father, when Paul was young. It was just that straightforward and matter of fact.
Venice is very soft. Romantic,
Nicola continued.
But look close. She is a hard way of life. Balance is difficult to find.
This resonated with Paul on two levels. First, there was a slight vertiginous feeling that followed you when constantly walking along narrow canals. Second, no fairy tale setting like Venice holds up under a microscope.
I have a theory that people leave their houses for market one morning and are never able to find their way back. Eventually, they just think, to hell with it, and settle somewhere else.
To hell with it, Nicola smiled. I like this theory.
You know, other cities with luxuries like transportation and grids and street signs.
According to Paul's guidebook, even the postmen didn't really know their routes, and had to rely on landmarks and shops for bearings. To Paul, this made the dog's phlegmatic gallivanting all the more impressive. Nicola leaned into Paul so that their shoulders touched, and he laughed. His breath smelled like cigarettes, but also sweet like a ricotta filling.
I have no idea where is my house.
Paul smirked. Then it's a good thing we're headed to mine. If the Italians could be this direct, so could he. He braced himself for rejection, Nicola's slamming on the brakes, but the waiter didn't so much as flinch. They crossed the Grand Canal at the Ponte dell'Accademia, farther down than the Rialto. They stopped at the bridge's center, and without the market stalls that lined the larger bridge, they were able to look out in the direction of the bay. They stood in silence. It was Nicola who spoke first.
Do you like being alone?
I have to. There is no one else here.
I am here.
Nicholas said, and he smiled. I'm getting used to it. Being alone, it's new for me.
The city is your friend.
Paul smiled bashfully.
Does this scare you?
Nicola asked. The question took Paul by surprise. Scare wasn't the right word, even if being alone unnerved him. He shook his head no.
What does, then?
Paul didn't understand this line of questioning. Did he seem afraid? Or was this Nicola shirking the banal in favor of something deeper, in the way Americans seldom did? The real answer was that Paul was scared he'd reach the age where life stopped giving you things and started taking away. But instead, he said, long silences. You.
People who are not themselves, Nicola said.
And Paul thought it was a perfect answer. They watched as a wooden motorboat cruised under the bridge. Do you know the story of the scorpion and the frog? Paul asked. Fable, I guess, is more accurate. They both leaned on the bridge so that their hands overlapped. Nicola's skin was much tanner than his, with a bit of dark hair below his knuckles.
Scorpion. Scorpione. It stings?
Exactly. A scorpion and a frog meet on the bank of a stream, and the scorpion asks the frog to carry him across on its back. The frog asks, how do I know you won't sting me? And the scorpion replies, because if I do, I will die too. Nicola nods his understanding.
They will both sink.
And looks at Paul to continue. The frog is satisfied, and so they set out, the scorpion on the frog's back. But midstream, the scorpion stings the frog.
Why?
Nicola utters, as if shocked. The frog feels the onset of paralysis. Paul gasps, then freezes up to demonstrate in case the word doesn't translate. He starts to sink. They are both going to drown. The frog has just enough time to ask, why? He points to Nicola to show he asked the right question. And the scorpion replies, because it's my nature.
And they drown?
They drown.
È la mia natura.
Because it's my nature, Paul repeated. I don't know what made me think of that, he added. But he did know. Sometimes even when people are themselves, you should still be afraid.
In Venezia, you cross many streams. Always can be dangerous.
Again, Nicola's stripped-down English came across as profound.
We are midstream right now, Paul agreed. But we don't need frog.
Paul smiled. No, not when we have this bridge.
Are you afraid I sting?
Nicola asked. Paul looked into his new friend's brown eyes. All these questions about being afraid. No, he replied. And he wasn't. As they walked the road in front of his loft, Paul picked up the now empty saucer. There was a pang in his heart, like he'd just missed the dog. But he reasoned his offering could have been taken by any of Venice's denizens. This is mine, he said of the dish.
You have espresso in the street?
Nicola's tone was bemused. Paul dismissively replied, long story, as he fumbled with the key to his loft. The lock stuck, as it always did, so Nicola gave it a try.
The air is damp,
the Italian offered as explanation. Nicola threw himself against the door once, and then twice, and gave it a good tug back toward them before trying the key again. This time, it worked.
Voila,
he said, which was French. Inside, Paul flipped on the lights and slipped off his shoes.
"Make yourself comfortable," he told Nicola as he discreetly placed the leftover lasagna in the fridge.
He opened a bottle of Sangiovese he'd bought the night he arrived and poured them each a glass.
They talked and drank, and the pull between them was palpable, something Paul hadn't experienced for a long time. They stood in the open picture window, leaning on the balustrade, the cold air and the company making him feel absolutely electric.
Nicholas said he preferred winter in Venice, as the city was overrun with cruise ships in summer and the canals had an unpleasant smell. He spoke in more detail about living in Italy, about what had drawn him to Venice, and what he knew would eventually drive him away. He wanted to be an artist, he confided, but the tourists were not interested in art, just trinkets that were largely imported from the East. As they spoke, Paul topped off their glasses, the wine thoroughly warming their insides. Paul came clean about his obsession, describing the dog in detail, down to the white stripe on his snout. He remained, however, tight-lipped about why his imagination was so captured. He pointed at the walkway where the saucer had been, the spot where he'd first noticed the creature. He hoped his guest might have seen him around, be able to offer a clue as to his regular haunts, but Nicola confessed he did not know of such a dog. He took Paul's wine glass and set it on the side table next to his own. While shorter than Paul by about 2 inches, he took charge by putting his hands around the American's waist.
Paul mumbled nervously something about an exhibit he'd seen at the Guggenheim, hoping it would spark a connection, get them to talk more about art.
But the connection was already sparked, and Nicola rested a finger on Paul's lips until he fell quiet, and then replaced that finger with a kiss. Paul hadn't kissed anyone since Darren. At least not anyone he could recall. There had been a drunken night at a bar immediately after Darren had broken it off, a misguided attempt to go home with someone to get it over with, put some sort of punctuation on the end of their marriage. When he'd woken up with a pounding hangover, the events of the night had been a haze. If he had made out with someone, certainly it was nothing like this. Two strangers cast in the long glow of moonlight on the other side of the world. Paul leaned into his guest for fear the shock of the moment might cause him to fall backward over the railing. Yet he quickly found his sea legs, and they kissed hungrily as if starving, their mouths tasting faintly like dark cherries from the wine. Eventually, Paul pulled his guest toward the ladder that led to the sleeping platform. It was amazing how a new body could feel so different. Firm where Darren was soft, hairy where his ex was smooth. It was both more exciting and less. He didn't know the nooks, the smells, how his own body would look in comparison, the places he would fit. But he was in the moment, eager to discover it all. They climbed the ladder, Nicola first, unbuttoning his shirt with one hand, pulling himself up with the other. They collapsed on the bed, Nicola pinning Paul's arms over his head. He was rough, but gentle. In control, but not menacing. Sensing correctly that Paul needed someone to take charge. Paul wanted to ask if he did this often, preyed on men dining alone. But he also didn't want an answer. Instead, he allowed Nicola to lash his belt around Paul's wrists, slipping it through the buckle, then wrapping the leather around his own fist, pulling it tight. With his free hand, Nicola slowly teased up Paul's pants. Exposed, Paul gave way to the enormous emotional comfort of another's body weight on top of him. Sex with this stranger had to be like wandering Venice. He could look up, he could look down, but there were too many corners to map far ahead. To be like the dog, he had to remain in the moment. Paul woke with a start, and the unnerving feeling of a shadowy figure lurking over him. He could just make out Nicola, already half-dressed. "It's you," he said, as if vaguely recalling a dream.
"It's me," Nicola replied, while zipping his pants before working his belt through the loops.
Paul felt his bare wrists, surprised not to find the belt there.
"You won't stay?"
"No,"
Nicola replied, soft but firm.
"Stay," Paul cajoled. "In the morning I'll make us espresso."
"You'll make us sit in the street,"
Nicola teased.
"We'll sit by the window."
The loft hadn't felt empty before, when it was just him, but Paul knew it would feel dreadfully bare once his guest left. He was eager to invite someone into his routine. Nicholas said nothing but smiled as he slid on his shoes.
"There's cake and maybe some cheese."
Paul struggled in his haste to remember. Whatever was in his fridge, they wouldn't starve. He could even run out for some fruit if need be.
"Perhaps we'll see the dog from the window."
"I have to get home."
"You can't find your home, remember?"
Paul pulled Nicola by the arm toward the bed, cajoling him to climb back in. Nicola smiled, confirmation that he remembered the joke.
"Why do you have to go?"
Paul could feel it bubbling to the surface, the desperation that had killed his marriage. It had left him for a few hours, but, like a boomerang, it came whipping back with surprising force. He glanced toward the window for his mentor, hoping to see the dog's shadow in the moonlight, amplified in the night like a monster.
"Because," Nicola said, "I have a girlfriend."
Paul sat upright, leaning back against the headboard.
"A girlfriend?" If he'd said anything else, Paul could have understood, at least chalked it up to the ambiguity in translation, but girlfriend was pretty universal, pretty unambiguous.
He felt angry, as if Nicola had been dishonest.
"Is this what you do?
Smoke cigarettes in the night and hustle wounded tourists?"
"What is hustle?"
Paul grew angrier still. Nicola's English seemed to take leave of him when convenient.
"Take advantage of."
Nicola shrugged. "Is that what I did?"
He seemed amused, backlit in the ambient light.
"Then why are you here?"
Nicola stopped, as if he hadn't really thought about it. As if following Paul home had been the most natural thing in the world. He leaned down and kissed Paul on the forehead, running his fingers through his hair. Paul gave him one last look, desperate for an explanation. Nicola sighed.
"È la mia natura."
Alone the next morning, Paul wrapped a blanket around his naked body and headed straight for the window in hopes of seeing the dog. To the left, he saw three small motorboats tethered to their doorways, two with tarps over their seats. A couple walked hand in hand over the narrow footbridge, and there was the faint echo of laughter. But no dog. To the right, a blue and white striped barber pole leaned like the Tower of Pisa out of the murky canal. The morning sun burned down, reflecting off the canal's easy ripples, diamonds of light spilling across blue velvet that made him squint. With no sign of the dog in that direction either, he raised his arm to shield his eyes and withdrew into the apartment. He sat, agitated and adrift. What he'd thought would be a giant leap forward, a casual encounter with a handsome stranger, had actually set him reeling back. He deserved the connection, had every right to experience great sex. So why did he feel so aimless and more alone than ever? He paced in the apartment. With the furniture, it only allowed him 5 steps in either direction.
He stared at the coffee maker but couldn't make himself add grounds to brew. He looked in the fridge. There was an emptiness inside him that food would not fill. He cursed Darren for doing this to him, abandoning him to undertake this trip alone. They should have been off for a breakfast together, a coffee and croissant in true Venetian style before undertaking a leisurely romantic day. Instead, he was spiraling, swathed in a blanket like it was some sort of cocoon, except what emerged would never be beautiful. More determined than ever to find the dog, Paul threw on his clothes. Knowing the bites of lasagna he'd saved would not do well in his pocket, he wrapped cubes of cheese in a paper towel to bribe the dog if he found him. Instead of walking his usual route towards Piazza San Marco, he headed in the opposite direction, into Castello, in hopes of finding more locals and perhaps the dog's owner. The buildings in this residential neighborhood were mostly brick and rust-colored stucco, the odd one a shade of marigold. The roof lines had a more uniform aesthetic, like they were made of perfectly cleaved flower pots. He paused in a small cafe, desperate for a large, black, American-style coffee to give him the jolt he needed for his search. The barista was deep in a heated argument with two brutish men whose jackets were caked with dirt. Paul was definitely off the beaten path. There wasn't a tourist around. The men argued loudly about something he assumed to be sports or politics, two things that universally provoked men's ire. And his brain still foggy, Paul grew increasingly intimidated. There was something about not being able to understand conversation that made one feel particularly forsaken. He had all but turned to leave when the barista finally acknowledged him with a grunt. Nervous, Paul's Italian failed him, and he was somehow served a cup of steamed milk. Maybe he had ordered it, maybe he hadn't. Maybe the men in this place were trying to hassle him, move him along from their turf. Paul threw down a few coins, muttering, "Grazie," hoping his dog didn't belong to one of these thugs. Plenty of mutts were about in the morning sun, but not a single one looked familiar. Here, they were largely ignored by locals, but appeared friendly nonetheless. A few came right up to Paul to be petted. They came in a variety of colors and trims, mostly medium in size, and all had a similar air as the object of his fascination, but not quite the confidence to roam. Otherwise, they'd have left Castello. "There are tourists a few blocks over," he wanted to tell them. "Rubes for your angelic faces." Although he pointed in various directions, he couldn't think how to make the dogs best understand, and they just cocked their heads and stared. Yet for the most part, they remained remarkably calm. And why not? They were liberated and free. They stood in stark contrast to New York City dogs, who never stopped to be admired, keeping at all times a frenetic pace as if the only safety was the interior of a Park Avenue apartment. Particularly Upper East Side dogs, overbred for status-obsessed owners and emotionally wrecked by having to exist on an island with millions of people, all equally high-strung. He wondered if that was just it. He was a New York dog, while most everyone he'd met, including Darren, despite being from Ohio, was more European. Paul himself would cop to a nervousness that he could never let go of, egged on by New York's relentless pace. Perhaps that was why he was always so desperate to commit. He remembered a confrontation with Darren that was typical of their relationship. They were in Lincoln Square one evening, trying to decide on a movie. "What about that one at 7:15? Paul pointed up at the marquee. "It has Diane Keaton." He wondered, how bad could it be? "She plays a cheerleader," Darren scoffed. "That's why it sounds fun." "At her age, it doesn't make sense. She's practically arthritic." "They all play cheerleaders. That's the point. It's about a squad of retirees." Paul had done his best to sound optimistic. Even a bad movie would get them off the street and into the air conditioning, where he could enjoy the darkness and a box of Junior Mints. But he knew, to lure Darren, he would have to sell it just right. "Let's just walk around," Darren had countered. "Maybe we'll stumble on something better to do." The way he said it, it almost seemed that simple, even though Paul knew how the evening would play out. They'd walk around until they got tired or sweaty, then grab some takeout, something familiar, maybe Vietnamese, and the food would be all wrong for their moods. Eventually, Paul would go to bed frustrated, knowing what Darren and others did not. It was rare for something better to come by. He tried not to grow angry thinking about it. Darren was his past, the dog his future, and, as a solo traveler, a solivagant, Paul no longer had anyone stopping him from doing as he pleased. He redoubled his search for the dog. He moved on to Via Garibaldi, one of Venice's rare wide streets. The guidebook told him it had once been a canal, but had some time ago been filled in. Absent a tour group to spy on, Paul relied on his book for these morsels. It was the only reason he still carried it in his coat pocket, as its maps had proven useless, a tangle of writhing snakes. He saw several more dogs, none his. Perhaps the dog was too smart to linger among the locals, knowing he'd never encounter more than a sour face taunting him with steamed milk. In the next canal, Paul found a moored boat selling produce and purchased a few clementines. He spotted a quiet doorway in which to sit and peeled one of them for a snack. His phone buzzed, startling him. He had begun to feel unreachable and liked being untethered from the outside world. It was an email from Amazon, confirming a package had shipped. Darren buying things still on their joint Prime account. Paul wanted more than anything to click through to the order, to see what Darren had bought for his new life without him, but reasoned no good could come from it, at least without the fortification of a stiff drink. But, with the dog nowhere in sight, his resolve was short-lived, and after finishing two clementines, he clicked the link in the email. A stainless steel bread maker, boasting three pan sizes and crust settings, was somewhere in New York on the back of a truck. That son of a bitch! They'd had a sourdough starter a few years back, but it had fizzled. Darren's interest had been threadbare. But his new life, apparently, would rise from a foundation of yeast and other ingredients. The bread maker even had a dispenser for fruits and nuts. One reviewer called using the machine, quote, a religious experience. Unbelievable. Now, fully fighting rage, Paul pulled out his guidebook and flipped to the pages on San Rocco. The Chiesa di San Rocco was the only church in Venice designed as a sacrarium to hold the remains of its titular saint. It's like the Guggenheim that way, he thought. He stared absentmindedly at the photos in his book as he peeled a third clementine, the juices running down his fingers and onto the steps. In one afternoon, he could visit both the church and the saint himself, the patron saint of dogs and the falsely accused. Take that, Darren, who apparently was seeking a religious experience from bread. Paul, at least, had an actual saint. What did Darren have? A high-speed agitator to make dough. Paul thought it clear who was winning. The Chiesa di San Rocco had a beautiful marble facade mottled with dark streaks, the front of the church decorated with statues. Carved into the stone above the main entrance was a relief of the saint, propped up by a staff, arm outstretched, healing the victims of plague. Paul stood in the square between the church and the Scuola Grande di San Rocco, letting people mill about him, squinting in an attempt to make it appear that San Rocco was reaching out to him, but gave up when he couldn't get the right angle. The Scuola
was supposedly filled with magnificent paintings, but while open to the public, it was not what he'd come here to see. Instead, he weaved in and out of the crowd, trying to peer through their legs in search of four paws, the front two of them white, working a telltale hustle. Sadly, everyone stood upright. He waited to feel some special connection, an enlightenment of sorts. He stood in the square for the better part of an hour, and despite the cloudless blue sky and the way the afternoon sunlight made the church's marble glow pink and the sound of Italian words melting together in verse, nothing like that ever came. In a last-ditch effort, he entered the church and lit a candle at the altar. Paul had never been much for prayer, but he'd also never been inside a church as ornate as this, with an actual saint interred. That had to count for something. He made his silent wish as he looked up at the stunning paintings that lined the ceilings and arches, men bowing before an all-powerful God. "Please send the dog my way." He then laughed, wondering if God would answer the prayer as asked, or assume that Paul was dyslexic. Discouraged and ready to call it a day, he skirted the dwindling crowds through a quiet alleyway. As usual, he kept his eyes trained on the ground. He felt the first rumbling pangs of hunger, the clementines now a memory. Yet he was also stuffed with self-pity, and he wondered, as he often did of late, which parts of himself he'd inherited. Did he have himself to blame for his utter distaste for being alone? Or was it his father's fault for leaving when Paul was a child? His mother's for having immediately remarried? Whose history could he claim? Whose was he burdened by? Or was the answer no one's? This train of thought was one more in which he was totally alone. Paul didn't know exactly what made him glance up when he did. Something stirred from deep within. Just ahead, where the alleyway opened into a small piazza, he spotted the dog sitting in a halo of light. He sat by himself, his weight on his haunches, listening to choral singers performing Baroque music at the open door of a small chapel. The voices were elegiac, beautiful, ricocheting off of the buildings on all sides of the piazza, enveloping them in music. Paul didn't recognize the song, something akin to Handel. The choir's voices vibrated on his skin, making his arm hairs stand on end. Or maybe it was the excitement of finding the dog, a prayer answered that made his heart stand still. Either way, Paul crouched slowly before the open chapel, careful not to get too close. It was finally just the two of them. He didn't want their meeting to end before it began. The dog licked his chops and sat, shifting his balance from one paw to the other, uncertain what to make of this moment. Together, they listened, the dog inching toward the door and sitting again, howling occasionally to add his voice to the choir. Confident he'd earned the dog's trust, at least enough not to spook him, Paul approached the chapel. A cool draft blew through the stone doorway. He already knew in future retellings he would describe this moment as haunting. "I want to be just like you," he whispered to the dog, scanning the piazza to see if others could hear. Everything around them was still. "I admire you," he added, reaching into his pocket for cheese. "Your utter comfort being on your own. Here." The dog sniffed his fingers and accepted the cube of cheese. Paul immediately regretted too easily offering his reward. He spoke again quickly, fearing the dog would have his fill of him. "I was hoping you'd teach me your secrets,
but now that I say that out loud, it sounds silly. Sillier still, it occurred to Paul that even if the dog understood human words, he was used to hearing Italian.
Segreti? Secrets?
The dog refused to tear his eyes from the chapel and cocked his head, confused.
My heart hurts all the time, and I want it not to. Hurt. How do you do it? How do you find so much confidence in being alone?
Despite the music and the strange circumstances of their meeting, Paul held the dog's attention.
It's my last night in Venice. I'm leaving tomorrow to go back to New York. I came here with nothing, desperately wanting to leave with something. Some small bit of wisdom that might once again fill life with joy. And somehow I fixated on you as the teacher. Professore, see? I convinced myself that you know the way. But I don't know that I'm built like you. I don't know that I could be your pupil.
Paul heard voices from the alley and turned, but Fortune smiled and they were headed the opposite way. He looked around at the stone walls that boxed him in. They looked wet in the way Venice was always damp, even though it hadn't rained at all during his stay. The building across from the chapel had two north-facing windows, with their shutters closed and their flower boxes empty. They looked like eyes that were sleeping. Another wall had faded tiles with a pattern that made the wall look stained with tears. The setting sun barely kissed the rooftops. All of it so lonely, so void of life, except for his dog and the music. Paul started to cry. And then the dog cried too, whimpered right alongside him. It washed over Paul. How silly he'd been. The dog wasn't any more comfortable alone than he was. He was just used to it, accepting that people behaved in ways that let you down. It was their nature. Here, faced with a stranger and something he couldn't explain, the dog, too, was afraid. But he stayed anyhow to experience it. Perhaps how to be alone wasn't even the lesson he was seeking. How to be present was. There were music and wonder in life to be had, and yes, sometimes it was nice to experience it with another, but it didn't come from being with someone else. The world could be appreciated alone, even when it felt scary.
"Does this scare you?"
Nicola had asked. In this moment, Paul could honestly say that it didn't. He scratched the dog behind his ears. His fur was both wiry and soft. He offered him a second cube of cheese, and the dog bowed as he chewed, doing that waggish, head-down, eyes-up thing that had made George Clooney a star. The dog swallowed, then offered its paw. A gesture of thanks? Or goodbye? Paul started crying harder. He accepted the handshake, cupping the paw in his palms. The dog made meaningful eye contact, as if telepathic, holding Paul's attention until he turned his gaze back to the chapel. Dazed, Paul barely noticed when the dog pulled his paw free, trotting away from him down the alley. When it dawned on him what was happening, Paul didn't look. He couldn't bear to see him go. Paul remained crouched for a time. He wasn't sure how long. Seconds, minutes, as long as it took to gather the strength to stand. The choir finished their hymn and began a second. The tempo brisker this time, a lone voice singing a Vivaldi-like aria, the song less solemn, the effect more operatic. Paul turned to face the small church while removing his cap, then wiped the tears from his face. He stepped forward slowly, approaching the entrance with reverence, until he was close enough to stick his head through the door. The air inside was even cooler than the January dusk, and it moved ever so slightly around him, as if circulated by a weak fan. The chapel was empty, lit mostly by candles. There was no center aisle, and only 6 rows of pews. None of the paintings that made the Chiesa di San Rocco so ornate. And no choir. No soloist. Where were the singers? Where were these angelic voices coming from? He stood, dumbfounded, until just to the left of the door, a faint glint of light caught his attention, and Paul strained his eyes to see. It couldn't be, he thought. But it was. An old iPod plugged into speakers. Fraud. It was fraudulent. All of it. The most genuine connection of his trip, facilitated by a swindle. Paul backed out of the doorway, stunned, speechless as if he'd seen a ghost. No wonder the dog had stopped in his tracks. He knew this wasn't right either. Modernity had no place in a setting like this. An artifice had cheapened this moment, and yet when confronted with both, he hadn't recognized them until they were staring him in the face. More so, he was moved by them. He was still on the verge of tears. But instead of tears, came laughter. Paul burst into uncontrollable giggles that emanated deep from within, the kind of laugh that was cleansing. His marriage, his inability to be alone, the dog, Nicola, Nicola's girlfriend, his search for meaning, all of it seemed silly. He listened as his laughter reverberated around the piazza, replacing the music from the iPod. Eventually, he had to cup his hands over his face to control himself. When he was finally able to collect his breath, he shoved his hands into his pockets and they squished the last of the cheese. And then the very idea of his carrying cheese in his pocket was funny, rolled in lint, as it must have been. And he started laughing again until he was most of the way back to his loft. Paul lay in the bed where Nicola had been, his shoes dangling off the edge of the mattress. He could still smell the faint whiff of cigarettes on his bedsheets, which would have annoyed him in New York, but seemed romantic in Europe. It actually brought him some comfort. He wasn't entirely alone, even when he was. There were echoes of people all around him. Il Scorpione. His nature. Paul still didn't know what Nicola had meant exactly. Was he bisexual, straight, a liar? Maybe it wasn't important for him to know. Still, Paul wondered, between the two of them, who was really the tourist? Perhaps he was more capable of being alone than he thought. At least, in any given place, he knew someone. Himself. On a whim, he opened his web browser and searched New York City Animal Rescue to look at photos of dogs. A few clicks and his screen filled with one sad face after another. He scrolled through organizations, scanning their pleas for help. Sad dogs, mean dogs, injured dogs, ugly dogs. Volunteer, spread the word, get involved, donate, bingo night, auction, raffle tickets, win, win, win. It was all overwhelming for his last night in Italy.
He should have been researching where to eat, what kind of pasta to enjoy for a last meal before returning to a country that feared gluten. He chastised himself for falling back on old habits, as if already he were devising a way not to be alone when he returned to New York. But something in him, laziness, exhaustion, depletion, ennui, kept him scrolling until he stumbled on something he didn't know he was still looking for in earnest. A sign. Like the markers that led to Piazza San Marco and ultimately his way back to the loft, a name jumped out at him as if to light his way home. Rocco. A dog named Rocco. Paul carefully thumbed through the photos on his screen. The dog was blonde, almost shockingly so, and only had one eye. His nose was black, as was his wry smile, which seemed to tilt ever just so to one side. In the photos, he wore a bandana, which gave him an air of sophistication, a look Paul himself had tried to emulate by purchasing the scarf. In that way, they were simpatico. The accompanying text described a friendly dog with a crippling case of separation anxiety and suggested Rocco would do best with someone who worked at home. Paul worked from home 2 days a week, and his office allowed dogs. Surely that would make him a good fit. Rocco's desire for companionship wasn't a defect, and Paul felt it shouldn't be advertised as such. In fact, to him, it was an asset. He looked at his watch. In New York, it was just past noon. He stared at the photo of Rocco, and back at his watch, then back at Rocco again. He kicked off his shoes to get comfortable, then sat up to compose an email. The sun rose on his final morning, casting its familiar light across the loft. In the open kitchen, Paul packed the double-shot filter with rich grounds to make his last cappuccino, inhaling deeply to rouse himself, and added milk to the machine to froth. He served himself what was left of the panettone, microwaving it a bit to soften it. As he waited for his coffee to brew, he cleaned out the fridge, tossing the bites of lasagna and the uneaten cheese, and dumping the last of the wine. He took his breakfast to the window, pulling aside the gauzy drapes. The dog was not there, but then Paul hadn't expected him to be. Not this morning. The dog was no longer his, and had never been to begin with. He was, no doubt, off panhandling the new arrivals, perhaps capturing the imagination of someone else disembarking into the city. He pulled his phone from his charger and spotted two missed texts from Darren. I was up all night moving the last of my stuff. I'll come back to clean. Just need a few hours rest. Have a safe flight home. Paul stared at the screen, feeling numb. And then it hit him. Why did he have to go home? Progress had been made, but there was more work to be done. And it could only be done if he stayed present in this moment, answering only to his whims. So he texted back. Take your time. I've decided to spend a few days in Berlin. He had no idea what had made him write that, other than the fact that the in-flight magazine on the plane had listed it as a top city for solo travelers. It had a high score on what they had coined the happiness scale. Traveling alone had pushed him outside his comfort zone, but it had also pushed him outside the zone of Darren's expectations of him, and he couldn't help but smile, imagining his ex reacting to his announcement. As soon as he hit send, he knew it was exactly what he wanted to do. He called the airline to change his flight. At 10:30, he said goodbye to the apartment, dropped the keys in the owner's mailbox as instructed, and walked over to a larger canal to meet his water taxi. As he waited, he took everything in one last time, pondering how you ever leave a city like this. You don't, he realized. You leave with a bit of it inside you.
When his taxi arrived, he handed the boat captain his suitcase and settled in the stern. As they navigated slowly back down the canal, Paul returned a friendly wave from a woman ashore. Then he watched the city recede in the distance as they picked up speed in the bay. Venice had been built as a trading city, a place for commerce, especially for silk and for spice, the world's first true international financial center. But while he was there, Paul had traded in other commodities. Self-doubt for self-confidence. Heartbreak for renewal. An old love for a new sense of self. He watched as a curious gull flew alongside him, pacing the boat until it had no choice but to land on a pylon to rest. As he sped toward the airport, Paul made the last bargain of his visit to Venice. He would never need anyone again unless they were open to needing him too. The world was full of wonders to experience, and he, alone, was enough to discover them. This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Stephen Rowley, performed by Neil Patrick Harris. Executive producers, Carrie Colon and Thomas Mann. Directed by Thomas Mann. Acquisition and development, Louise Quayle. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzuk. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Stephen Rowley. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.